Welcome to The Derivative by RCM Alternatives, where we dive into what makes alternative investments go, analyze the strategies of unique hedge fund managers, and chat with interesting guests from across the investment world.
Hello there. Who wants to talk trucking? We all see semis crisscrossing the country, but what is really happening behind the scenes with the logistics, tie-ins to the larger economy, and venture and private equity investment into this old, boring industry? We sat down with Chris Jamroz, CEO of Roadrunner Transportation Systems, to hear all the details. Send it. This episode is brought to you by RCM. From clearing to execution, portfolio construction to outsourced fund ops, China to Nebraska, RCM has you covered for all things futures and derivatives. Learn more at rcmalts.com. And now back to the show. All right, everybody, we're here with Chris Jamroz. Chris, how are you?
I'm very well. Thank you very much, Jeff. Thanks for having me on.
No worries. Where in the world are you these days?
We are at the Roadrunner head office here in Chicago.
All right. But it's out. I take offense to people who actually call it Chicago. It's in the burbs, right?
Chicagoland. In the burbs.
Chicagoland. Exactly. And where are you?
Activity off different areas. So Chicago and the suburbs, it's an easy lane for us.
And but you split your time? You're not full-time in Chicago, are you?
No, I mean, there's a limited effectiveness to my role and just being in the head office. I do spend a fair amount of time on the road visiting our terminal locations, our partners, vendors, customers, and that sort of takes me across the continent.
Mm, lucky. The continent, not the states, the continent. We'll get more into that. But to start out, just if you could give us kind of a high level, you've got so much on your CV there that it would be take up the whole pod to go through the whole thing. So if you can kind of give us a high level of what you've been up to and how you found yourself here at Roadrunner in that cool t-shirt.
So I think I'll describe myself as sort of a serial logistics entrepreneur and a sort of a turnaround specialist. I usually partner up with financial sponsors and in logistics platforms exclusively across transportation and logistics. And at this point, I think in every possible mode of supply chain that I'm aware of, and through all different facets of supply chain. And I sort of specialize in effectuating successful exits for shareholder groups and management teams through creating value and operationalizing what was perhaps envisioned investment thesis and at some point in time didn't go exactly as planned. And I just find it fascinating to extract so much value from undermanaged operational enterprises within the supply chain.
And is that usually an IPO, or it could be a private sale, or it could be a merger, it could be all of the above?
It could be everything, and I've done everything. I've done IPOs and secondary offerings to get to effectuate exits for management groups and obviously shareholder constituency. But we've done exits through outright sales, through mergers, through spin-outs, so through just everything you could possibly imagine as far as. But what the essence of that is that we've created companies that are attractive, that are valuable, that they perform a valuable, relevant service in industry and generate economic profit and become attractive target for someone, either investors or strategics, to take a very serious interest in.
And it's over, in your bio here, over 100 acquisitions? That seems like a lot.
Yeah, a lot.
You're not that old. Yeah.
Thank you. I probably am a little older than I look, but yeah, it's been a lot more than 100. It's just it's just incredible how you think. You know, I remember my first one and how stressed I was, and now we're trying to add all of those things up, and it goes into such large numbers. But you learn a lot through those transactions. You learn by mistakes always. I think that's the only form of learning you can do. You learn a lot more from success. And I've done tremendous amount of mistakes and erred a lot. I think what you learn through that is just you increase the velocity of your decision making. So you become smart in the process. You take a lot of wisdom from lessons learned, but at the same time, the increased velocity of decision making helps you make the right decisions and correct the wrongs a lot faster. But it is a collective. The value of collective lessons learned is quite incredible.
And so all of this has culminated in the current two roles. It seems like you have many more than just the two roles, but two of the more prominent ones are here at Roadrunner and at Global X. Which one you want to jump into first?
Oh, definitely Roadrunner. Roadrunner is my life.
Okay.
I've cleaned my plate to be singularly focused on this platform. Is the most spectacular comeback story in the recent decades of transportation. We fixed a company that was beyond broken, and we performed against all odds. There wasn't a single person who would bet in our favor. It would be nonsensical to do so, but we did it. We did it with a fantastic team. With the help of great customers, and it's kind of this is what I think I love the most about what I get to do, is taking and extracting value and creating sustainable operating platforms in the times where everybody else would seem to have given up on them.
So tell us, Roadrunner, what you guys do.
So Roadrunner is a less than full truckload LTL player in the market, which basically means that we consolidate customers' freight inside our trailers. So we don't have a single trailer dedicated to a single customer. In every of our trailers, there's probably a lot of freight coming from a dozen or more shippers. And we specialize in transporting freight directly, point to point, over long distances. So we are, if you need to get your freight from Port of LA or Long Beach or LAX Airport to Chicago next business day, you call us on a Friday and gets there by Monday. That's sort of our calling card. We are, ultra fast. We affected an expedite LTL player, but we are operating on standard LTL rates. So we we provide a lot of value to shippers with sensitivity towards speed, quality of service, as well as the fact that people are very sensitive to damage or loss of freight in the process of transport. We have a very attractive alternative.
And for a rookie like me, why wouldn't I just use FedEx or something? These are bigger than they can handle. It's unique loads.
There's no. Our customers probably would not afford FedEx.
Oh, it's too expensive. Yeah.
This we're talking that FedEx is obviously a phenomenal courier, but that's what I would describe a small parcel courier offering versus bulky. We're talking about piece of machinery.
Like
500 pounds and of things like that. You cannot really lick it and put it in an envelope and seal it and off you go.
Yeah. And you guys own the trucks? You own all the hardware?
There's a mix. We have our own trucks that we work a lot with owner operators. We have the preferred destinations for owner operators. So we also pride ourselves in putting people in business, or small entrepreneurs to own their own business. We have plans for that, but we have a mix of power modes, but we are definitely the preferred destination for owner operators and team drivers.
And owner, I was going to touch on that later, but I remember a couple of years ago, Andrew Yang, when he was running for president, kept talking about truckers are the largest employer in, I can't remember how many states, 15 states or 18 states or something. I don't know if you have the math to back that up, but right. Like, so it's a huge industry of these owner operators. So you're actually bringing them under your umbrella. They become Roadrunner employees, or you just license?
Well, they have an option. No, we actually do pride ourselves in promoting the owner operator model, sort of independent of ours. We become, their destination and the key partner. But, I think it's something very American, extremely patriotic about it. I'm obviously a naturalized American. It's been my lifelong dream to live in the United States. I truly feel this is absolutely the best, country on earth. But there's something so incredibly noble that whether it's a native American that you can, you know, in a first generation and generations, you can build the business that suddenly you make $60,000, $70,000, $80,000. You can change the life for your family, for your loved ones. And then when you start building your fleet of trucks and you actually become a true entrepreneur and your small business grows, I think it's just incredible. And I really have struggled through working through so many different facets and modes of logistics. I really have never met a cohort of Americans or new Americans or aspiring Americans that is more patriotic than truckers.
Yeah. What are those trucks like? I want to get in one of those. Can you get me in one of those?
Absolutely.
All right.
Something so magical and just the allure of a truck that it has a little house and home attached to the back of your cab. It's just fascinating. Some people take to go to lengths to customize them. They look incredible, but it is quite an experience to be inside a sleeper cab.
Yeah. And what's a new one of those run me?
Those goes, you know, the prices have spiked, you know, post COVID, and now they're kind of normalizing. I mean, you need to kind of looking at, you know, 150 to 200 G's for a full rig. So it's not cheap. It's definitely cheap.
Well, it's cheaper than I thought it'd be because I'm in the ag business, right? Those combines and the big tractors are actually in those John Deere's are millions.
Massive, yeah.
And then can you want to touch on Global X now or leave it till later?
Sure. Global X is, you know, it was an offshoot investment and we led the transformative investment to the other airline pre-certification as part of the Roadrunner spin-off. So it's not completely unrelated. It's somewhat unrelated, obviously different mode of transport. And it is there's an incredibly fascinating story. It's the fastest growing charter airline in the United States. The objective is to be the largest operator of charter flights in the country. I think we are well on track to do so. There's a phenomenal management team. My engagement with that is obviously a little bit more hands-on chairman of the board, but the team is first class, and it's a fascinating story. Obviously, you see the earnings report yesterday with, you know, record revenues last year. The demand for passenger charters is as strong as you can only imagine. So great things to come from there.
So it's freight, air freight, or it's passengers?
Passenger predominantly with a little cargo operation as well.
Okay. So that's like, what's that one out on the West Coast that is doing, people keep telling me about the little private, but they're kind of not as nice as a full private. So it's like that, or it's just charter flights for?
These are charter flights for
teams,
you know,
or whatever.
Sports teams, college teams. We do, obviously, you know, being based in Miami, we fly to Caribbean and all those beautiful destinations. We serve in the overflow airline for larger thing. We work with tour operators like TUI in Europe. So it's just a very diverse end markets.
Got it. And what are those planes? They're modern planes?
They're modern, very modern Airbus 320s, 321s.
So with all this logistics background, I want to take a step back for a minute and talk kind of what you see being involved in all these logistics in terms of U.S. economy, global economy, right? Where the Fed's trying to get us on this perfect soft landing. So what are your thoughts with the front row seat you have of, are things slowing down? Are they speeding up? Where do you see the economy from your seat?
So Jeff, from a freight perspective, we've been in a recession for probably a better part of 92 weeks now. It is a freight recession post COVID spike. And so we've gotten accustomed to a very tough and a weak freight environment globally. That goes across different modes. Obviously, ocean shipping is in probably the worst shape of all the modes, followed by freight forward market that's very challenging, full truckload brokerage market is just challenging, expedite, pure broad expedite market is in very challenging conditions, etc. The LTL market is the one that is the most functional and the most resilient just because of number of macroeconomic factors, geopolitical factors, the change of buying habits, the nearshoring trends, all et cetera, which are all massive tailwinds driving right into the LTL space. But it is, you know, the freight environment continues to be very challenging and lackluster. It is, people tend to forget that freight is a commodity market, and commodity markets and commodity industry cycle. And it's just almost fascinating to me that even the smartest people sometimes tend to forget it. They forget it at the peak of the cycle when they think that this time will be different. And unfortunately, it always ends up the same way and ends up in tears. And then it's the people at the froth or the bottom of the market can't seem to be seeing past the doom and gloom. And at the same time, that shall pass too, as the Rumi, the poet, would say. So it's just a cyclicality. So you always, you know, certain number of quarters away from a change in the cycle, and it always happens a little bit faster on a down cycle and a little bit slower on an up cycle. And, you know, right now we are at the trough. There's, you know, what the Fed is doing is obviously, you know, very convoluted and complex, and just goes way beyond just the supply chain, because supply chain, in even its complexity and growth, still accounts for about 8% of the GDP. So significant, but not obviously all in all. And it's, you know, what happens with the economy, you know, that's probably a little bit be too speculative for me to opine, but the freight market will recover in the next probably 3 to 4 quarters, as it always has through cyclicality of the industry.
We have an old saying here in the commodity trader world of the cure for high prices is high prices, right? So that's what leads to this cyclicality. So dig in on some of those, what you just said earlier, like the nearshoring and some of those concepts of that I'm not familiar with and the listeners might not be familiar with, or if you want to go back to COVID, of what changed in freight during COVID and now what the post-COVID situation looks like in terms of...
Yeah, that's a fascinating question. And thank you for the opportunity, because I feel very passionate about it. So what has happened in the global supply chain? There was this obsession with China, an obsession with offshoring, an obsession with outsourcing. And effectively, what many manufacturers, many industries found themselves in a position of complete dependent on a very remote manufacturing base, you know, in Southeast Asia and predominantly China. And that was because of an ultra low labor cost and sort of very inexpensive transport market, and an effective transport market that, you know, the sailings from, you know, Hong Kong to LA were taking fewer and fewer weeks, and they were very inexpensive, and the whole world accustomed to that business model. COVID came and completely disrupted those dynamics. So first of all, you found yourself out without your manufacturing base. You thought you had one, but you just realized there is a certain economic and geopolitical realities when a country can shut you out of the market, can completely close your factories, and there's nothing you can do. And you find yourself without your capabilities, without your production, without the thing. And then you're looking at, you know, cost of shipping a container, which pre-COVID was about $3,000 to ship a 40-foot container. They're called, you know, TUs, 20-foot equivalent units. So the 40s, you see those on big container ships, you see them on the roads, the little like perforated metal, metal containers. These are the ocean containers. It used to cost $3,000 to get it from China to LA Long Beach port, which is the main entry port for all freight going to China. Now in COVID, that spiked to $27,000 per container. Mm. So just think about what it does to you, to your operation. First of all, you cannot get the product manufactured because a country shut down and it's not allowing your own workers to come into factories, and there's nothing you can do about it. Then it turns out it's not such a friendly jurisdiction as you may have thought previously. And secondly, it's prohibitively expensive to get that product out of there, even if you can get your hands on it. So after that, what dramatic shift is, I don't think there's a single CEO standing in front of any board in North America who would survive in their job without pitching and executing a credible strategy of reducing the dependence on China for all needs, sourcing needs, manufacturing needs, supply needs, any sort of arrangements. And what happened then is just this, there's been a love affair with Mexico, which kind of like, well, hey, listen, we have this, you know, relatively cheaper labor pool, not as cheap in China, but I can truck it from there. And yeah. They don't seem to be fighting against us. They seem to want to be friends. And notwithstanding the challenges that Mexico is dealing with on domestic policies, it's actually a very a country of great work ethic, relative proximity, relative cost arbitrage. So people just like rediscovered the neighbor to the south. And as you probably have seen last month, it was broadly publicized that Mexico has now eclipsed China as the U.S. main trading partner. There's no more important trading partner to the U.S. than Mexico. Now, when you step back a little bit, think like, okay, who's surprised about this? Raise of hands. Like, who's surprised? Like, literally, the guys are right next door to you, right? They have the same values. They work hard. They love families. They believe in God. They just, you know, have so many incredible parallels between the two societies, and they just hardworking folks. And it's just became such an, you know, such a phenomenon. But I grapple why, if it feels so intuitive. But you have this, and that's called nearshoring or friendly shoring or onshoring or whatever you call it. Yeah. So you're still playing the cost arbitrage. But you effectively, what you may lose on a more expensive labor, you gain on a reduced cost of transport, ease of thing, and speed to market. So think about all the industries from fashion, garments, etc. When they need quick runs, right? It's like, you know, if something is hot, if that particular piece of outfit is hot, if you can
we
get
need
it
more of it right now, yeah,
versus you can get it next 2 weeks. Well, it makes a difference. So, and there's also the language, you know, ability to, because we have obviously so many dual speakers, etc. So, but what happens is because it's so close, instead of building those huge loads that you need to fill the whole ship before you ship it, you can start shooting, you know, partial shipments, and you don't need to wait for this, you know, absolute trailers to fill. So suddenly there's this demand. Okay, how could we ship it effectively, cost effectively, at the good transit times? But I don't need to fill the full trailer. I produce this, I need to ship it. Well, here you go, LTL. This is exactly what we meant to do. So you have this massive tailwind of consolidating shipments, shipping from cross-border, coming from the south of the border, even from places like Laredo to anywhere in the country, or San Diego to anywhere in the country, and so forth. And on top of that, you have the e-commerce. And obviously, we've lived through, you know, 2020, 2021, 2022, where, you know, seeing the world seems to have changed for good, that Amazon was producing, delivering record results and record earnings. And obviously that has subsided. But what has not changed, that the people have changed their shopping habits. The e-commerce is driving. Again, e-commerce, when you buy it, you don't buy a full load, the full truck load of toilet paper. You just buy a package. So when you consolidate the shipments, again, who comes into your mix? LTL players. So this whole thing is just a transitional shift into favoring an LTL market that now accounts for $60 billion a year versus a full truckload market when you actually have to fill out the whole trailer, which is probably, you know, which is now, it's assessed at $120 billion. It's probably a lot larger, but think about it. LTL is now almost half of what's reported to be as a truckload market, which is just phenomenal. So it's a good place to be.
And how does that work for you guys? You were already in Mexico? You already had the...
Actually, not even in Mexico yet. So we go through prior experiences. I've done a lot of business in Mexico. It's a very interesting market. So we are exploring how we're going to do this. But it's more of the tide that raises all the boats, Jeff. We still are a small, relatively small play in LTL market. But I'm wanted just to give you the context of why this is such an attractive thing and how much runway is ahead of a company like ours, as we are just preparing to organizationally handle the cross-border Mexico to the U.S. and vice versa shipments. We are in Canada, and obviously that's a big trading partner to the U.S. as well for similar reasons. And that's obviously a wonderful capability that we have for ourselves.
So it seems like 5 years ago, it was we're making everything in China. We're all buying it on Amazon. Amazon's delivering it all to us, right? So it's kind of one, I'm oversimplifying a great deal, right? But kind of one big company, one big partner in China, one shipping route. And now you're saying, hey, now we have all these smaller players are kind of competing with Amazon. Plus we have all these different areas where the goods are coming from. So it's become much more diversified.
It is diversified. It's easier to do trade because they are part of the same trade zone. So you have people like Dominican Republic, Honduras. There's a lot of those, you know, near-based geographies with good opportune areas to set up manufacturing and production facilities. And I think the world is becoming a far more interesting place with the proliferance of them appearing as good partners to us.
Got it. And I think for those in the trading world listening, that's the peso has benefited from that. I think the peso is at like 5-6 year highs based on that strength.
Good for them.
Yeah. Right. And it, right. Like you said, it makes total sense of like, why haven't we been doing this the whole time? So we talked a little bit about it with rates. What do you see in terms of rates that hurts people trying to buy a new truck? That hurts, right? Does it hurt the overall logistics industry or your specific LTL and Roadrunner of rates remaining stubbornly high?
We are sort of I always think about this. We are the service provider to the community of shippers and buyers. So a weaker consumer would definitely have an impact on any transport business. Right now, I think what has happened over the last 2 years, a lot of people overbuilt the inventories because they were expecting the 2021, 2022 trends to continue, somewhat probably at the reduced pace, but they probably were caught absolutely unprepared with an absolute cliff off fall of demand and with huge inventories that they need to they needed to get rid of. And people have become very very careful how they stock the inventories and restock the goods. And this is sort of, we had such a low inventory level now that but people are still careful. So the interest rates definitely hurt anybody who needs to invest because capital is so incredibly expensive, right? I mean, if you try to remortgage or refinance your house over the last 5 months, you probably get a shock of a generation. Yeah. How painful that could be. So that obviously has a trigger effect because people are not investing as much. The consumer is still very strong in the US and defying the gravity, and the spending continues, which obviously accounts for nearly 3/4 of all GDP in the US. So that's very good to see. But things are more expensive, right? And capital is scarce. And I think, there's a big anticipation of the Fed starting to begin to lower the rates so that the investment phase of the economic expansion relaunches. And that, I think, is the premise of the soft landing and then managing the inflation. Inflation is sort of, people are surprised unless you've gone or you grew up in a country where inflation could wipe out your everything within a sort of a day or a month. So inflation is a very dangerous economic indicator, a very important one. So I applaud the Fed for keeping an eye on that and managing this because it is like cancer and very rapidly spreading cancer. But I think the way that it's being, I think it's not without risk, but I think all the indicators are shifting in favor of what would one describe as soft landing.
And but for you guys in particular, you would, if you have the demand, you're going to pay whatever rate you need to get new equipment, to get new, right? So it's more demand based than rate based.
I think we're agnostic. I want to just tell you that think we are. We cycle agnostic. That's the beauty of Roadrunner, the way we've built it, we've designed it. I can tell you that our financial results have never been as strong as they are now, even though we operate at the bottom of the cycle. So I cannot, nor I would accept an excuse of the economy because we are so small that we should outperform any cycle, any economic environment, etc. But to us, we are cycle agnostic, and it is we provide a service that is so important that it's just the demand that is going high. I'm sure there'll be times when it will be easier to win business and grow faster. But at the same time, I think we, with the way we've designed our levers here, position us quite favorably no matter what economic cycle we find ourselves in.
And I just got the name. Sorry, I'm slow. Like Roadrunner is fast. So you're getting these, right? You're getting them the service. You're getting them what they need quickly. The Roadrunner. And he's on the road, the Roadrunner.
That's right.
Do you guys got any pet Roadrunners there? I saw a few when we were out golfing in Arizona. They're just walking around the golf course. It's cool.
I think they're fast little buggers. They're fast. I mean, they run fast. And so do we.
And so do we. And then I want to go into a little bit. It's always been a little fascination of mine. Like, how far out are we, in your opinion, from automated trucking, automated shipping, like the far reaches of, okay, we don't even need any of these owner operator truckers who we just praised 10 minutes ago. Sorry, guys. Right. But is that on the horizon somewhere?
I think it's on the horizon somewhere. I think it's, you know, I always kind of take a, make a joke that, you know, the minute you can take a pallet from LA to Chicago and you can transport in metaverse, and, you know, count me out, I'm not showing up for work.
Yeah. You know, well, they won't need you anymore.
If anybody can convince me that that pallet with that part of engine or that consolidated freight can skip the forklift, skip the dog, skip the skip the human, I don't know. It would be interesting to see. Autonomous tracking, I think that's something that can help. I don't think it would ever replace, but I think it would substitute and help alleviate the gaps. And, you know, like, listen, it's, truckers work very hard. It's one of the probably hardest jobs you can imagine. I mean, it's so tolling on you physically, mentally. It takes you away from home and your loved ones for extended periods of time. I mean, I have so much respect for our driver partners. At times it loses its appeal as generations shift and retire. A few years ago, there was, you know, people talked and calculated there was about 300,000 shortage of drivers in the United States. And then COVID happened, and then there was, you know, that shortage became one of the best paying jobs. And then obviously, you know, a lot of people are leaving the trucking industry. So there's ebbs and flows and things, but I think there always will be the need for trucker. But I think the entry of autonomous vehicles over the period of next decade, I think, should alleviate some of the volatility and cyclicality of truckers within leaving and entering the market.
Hmm. And what I've read is that last mile is the hardest part for them to figure out, right? Of like, maybe you could be on the highway autonomous from LA to Chicago, but when you're getting off in Downers Grove and making that tight turn on such and such avenue and having to back into that stall to deliver it, that's the hard part. That's where you need the human.
True. And, you know, when you talk, the people use this first mile, final mile. Final mile means you have to take a washing machine out of the thing, take it on a dolly, drag up to somebody's condo and put it in the laundry room. So,
and know where it is in the truck too, right? Yeah.
So it's
not the only thing in the truck.
A little ways away from that.
Got it. But it's always fascinating to me. Like, what do you think the amount of investment into automation and robotics and AI is? Probably 100x what it is to kind of, I'll call your boring businesses here for a second. Don't take offense, but right, like, as compared to those guys,
pride,
like,
boring businesses.
Yeah, exactly. It's always interesting to me of like the smart money is probably like, hey, I'm going to invest in this thing over here, which nobody cares about, but which can throw off this great return.
Listen, there's so much capital invested in AI and automation and autonomous technology that it's bound to come through at some point. And I think it will make world a better place. It will make it more interesting. I just, you know, that's not something that it's in my business plan for the next year, that's for sure.
So speaking of investment, we'll pivot towards, so Roadrunner was PE owned or still is PE owned, or how does that all
work? So Roadrunner is a publicly traded company that has a very large majority shareholder, which is an institutional shareholder, but there's a lot of shareholders, institutional and private, in Roadrunner.
Okay. But you've been involved with a lot of these 100 plus acquisitions from private equity coming into the space. You told me offline, some of these guys, they're calling you like, hey, we bought this. It's not working out. Can you come fix it? So I want to dig in a little bit with you of just how you view private equity, how the companies themselves view private equity. If someone like you coming in, is there pushback? So I don't know if there's a question in there, but I'll ask the question. Does, from the company side, do the people view private equity as the devil or as an angel of like, oh, we're getting saved?
I think the sort of the bad rep from private equity came from the 1980s, where you had that sort of, you know, depicted in many movies and, you know, feature productions of this ruthless
barbarians at the gate.
Barbarians at the gate. You have the folks, you know, whether in the UK or here in the US, where people are just buying asset and kind of forming a financial arbitrage or divesting, shutting down, etc. But at the end of the day, private equity appeared as a very effective form of capital, effectuating a lot of changes that, well, at the time were very disruptive, that led to significant and outside value creation. I think it's an extraordinarily attractive constituents of capital. It continues to have very attractive returns, oftentimes outpacing the public market returns. And it's commonly associated with sort of a smart money investing, where people take the nonsense out of the equation and focus on what drives the most value. I think most private equity firms are very focused now on providing opportunities for the employee cohorts to build the wealth alongside those of shareholders and this sort of employee ownership model. Sponsored, you know, KKR is, you know, a leader in this. You know, I am personally a huge believer in that. So I love owners in the business, and I love being in the business with people who co-own the business. I think that changes and makes it more prideful. It kind of gives people a reason to give the best. And that's not always possible through other forms of ownership. When there is change, we humans, Jeff, so obviously people resist change. I've never had balloons and a cake when I first walked into the boardroom. I'm yet waiting for that one moment when there's a show and a magician, and I get a little pony and yeah, I get a cake.
There were daggers and shields, probably, right?
It's just like, you know, but it's at the end of the day, it's, you know, what you come in, you have, you know, it's never the people's fault, it's always the leadership failure. So when the leadership fails, and that's operational leaderships, and private equity firms, you know, they do buy businesses, but they really invest in management teams. And if those management teams fail, that obviously had a lot of negative externalities. So when you come in, you have probably, you know, a fairly a wounded and hurt employee cohort. Is just, you know, people may not feel as proud of being of affiliation and have been, you know, they've seen, you know, the stress, personal stress levels are elevated, etc. So it's not really that, you know, difficult to understand why. I do enjoy my farewell parties, though, when there is an exit event, when there's a liquidity event, monetization event, when people kind of, I love the letters, I love the stories, I love the messages, and those parties are a lot of fun. When I kind of go on to the next one, I see something that we've changed people's lives, and we've left them so much better than when we found it. And that would be difficult to do it without the private equity financial sponsors, hedge funds, and other members of that financial constituents. And I think that's interesting. And that's what I do, and that's what I love doing. And a Roadrunner now is my absolute passion. It became a little more personal than any other business before, just because of how hard we've all worked to turn around such an incredible operation.
And touch on what you said a second ago of like the hedge funds and the private equity coming in. Is it, and I think I'm going to know your answer, but is it their money or their skill in being able to get the right management and leadership in there, or a combination of both? Right? If they just had the leadership and not the money, would it still work?
The institution investors obviously represent not their own money. It's the limited partners funds. So they sort of an conglomerate aggregator of funding. But I think what they do bring is the discipline and freedom to act. So sort of removing the barriers that, you know, sometimes it'd be difficult to orchestrate such difficult turnarounds in the public market, where you have to stand in front of investors every 90 days and explain what you're doing. And that could be, you know, difficult, if not impossible at times. The private equity brings the discipline, the expectations of driving value, making quick moves, acting in a concerted, disciplined way and a decisive way. And also they give you the freedom for executives like myself. So it gives the freedom to act and do it with an expectation of creating value. So that's what I think is the main benefit of working with these players.
But the money's needed. So if they were like, it just removes that, we could really grow if we could do this, but we don't have the capital to do it. Right, removes that kind of barrier for ideation.
I think, Jeff, I think every company deserve the right to grow. And once you deserve your right to grow, the capital is easy to come by. The capital is an easy excuse that people that are inept or without results, etc. It's, you know, the greatest stories that I've seen, the greatest turnarounds that I've been privileged to be part of, they all came from scarcity of capital. And a lot of doubt and everything, because brings the best out of people. And then it's just capital is a byproduct of success. There are obviously different situations when somebody gives you a pot of gold and asks you to build something incredible. That's not the universe that I labor in. I labor in sort of very boring businesses, very basic industries. But the capital is never difficult to come by when you gain your credibility and confidence from your investor constituencies.
Is it hard for you to then have to leave eventually, right? If you build these connections, you build this.
Yeah, when we sold Ascent in December, first of all, the associates did not make it easy. I've never received as beautiful letters as I've received from Ascent. Personal stories, pictures.
And Ascent was part of Roadrunner and you spun it off?
It was part of this, it was a group of companies within a Roadrunner that we grouped together. We spun out in a private entity. We ran it for 3 years and we ultimately sold it. And that was just, it was very difficult to leave the thing. I take the business. I lived in my office for 7 months. So I actually had a pull out sofa in my office. I had a bathroom there, etc. So I lived in my office. It was a very personal thing. So it's just change is good. And, you know, when you see the new executive stepping in and you see the, you know, existing leaders stepping up and having an opportunity to orchestrate and drive their own, being the chief architects of their new future, it's I think that's what teacher probably must feel like when the kids graduate. But there's an absolute profound sadness and heartbreak that you're no longer part of their story.
That's got to be the toughest part. And one more, since we are a hedge fund podcast, I got to ask a few more of these hedge fund questions. But there's a feeling that there's too much money in private equity, right? And it's driving up prices. Like private company premium traded a premium to public markets now. They used to be at a discount because of their illiquidity. So are you seeing any of that? Maybe not in the companies you're involved with, but tangentially of like, yes, I can't believe that company just sold for X to private equity, like that valuations have gotten out of hand. Or maybe because you're in this recession in your space, it's been less.
I strongly believe that the markets are very effective, and particularly, you know, the global markets effective, and people are drawn to assets that are fair priced or fully priced. And I don't personally think that, you know, that's overpriced. I think it's just a maybe different form of valuing companies. When you think about, you know, hedge funds traditionally were, you know, public equities plays, right? That is, sort of they look at arbitrage in underpriced or overpriced markets and took either activist approach or just purely technical approach, you know, smartest money in the world. The private investors value things differently. You know, the public markets tend to target a forward-looking guidance. You buy into you're really leaning into the future story, how you're selling a public company. It's just you may not have anything to show for yourselves right now, but if you can sell it, you know, where you're going incredibly, and you have some credibility with the investors, you know, that's one part. The private equity investors value in a sort of what they call LTM, the last 12-month performance. And every indication is just people look at your past performance and they to me, they always remain a little bit skeptical of what the future guidance may otherwise be. So they've developed their own courage of conviction and their own sort of resolve around the asset's future, but they guided more of historic performance versus the private investors are the future. So I think at the times where you have a lot of uncertainty in the market, and the public market is where, you know, everybody participates, the retail investors, individual investors, as well as institutional investors, you have a lot of volatility and you may have a little bit subdued performance at the times of, you know, lackluster confidence, where the private equity investors are looking at the actual track record of performance and they tend to value assets based on that. So I think that could be, in my opinion, I don't see that much, you know, that always happens. There's always that one transaction everybody talks about. It's like, how on earth did they get that? How on earth somebody valued them at this? But it kind of seems to kind of normalize and regulate in time. So it's just, you know, it's a temporary emotional upheaval.
Wanted to touch real quick on, is it Lion 9 or Lion IX? Lion X. It's because that sounds like a hedge fund, right? So it's a private fund.
LionX is a fruit of love of mine. It's basically a group of us who move from platform to platform, from company to company, because obviously it's not just me. I wouldn't have done it with the team. And it's a certain degree of changing group of individuals, because some of them do fall in love with the companies we work for and do find themselves that they want to become permanent part of the fabric of these entities that we've turned around and built, and they leave the group, and there's obviously always new people who join and become incredible partners to me, and we move to another investment, etc. So I named our group Linux, and it's effectively, you know, a group of very operation minded executives who help effectuate exits for private equity firms and financial sponsors, hedge funds, and so forth. And we create value through operational discipline. We have a playbook, and we've done 7 exits. We're batting 1,000, and we're doing well. And, you know, I can't wait to see what the future holds.
Yeah, I love it. So I read in somewhere that it was doing like some leasing. Like, I was thinking it's like an aircraft leasing or a private credit fund, but not exactly. It's more
we do that too. But Linux is also my family office, the name of family office. So I do have an investment in equipment leasing businesses and real estate and a number of others, cybersecurity, etc. But the core quality is no different than any others, you know, family office, but the core of it is the group of remarkable individuals who are changing the shape of logistics and globally at this point.
Yeah. And so since you're on an alternative investment podcast, we'll have to ask you, what is the family office looking at? Any alternatives, managed futures, hedge funds? Do you do anything outside of logistics in those other companies?
I do have people who manage those things. I completely stand completely focused on operating the businesses, but yeah, we do obviously have many of our partners, the hedge funds that who own majority of the business infrastructure. They often are the people who
invest
my money in. So I know that. So that's sort of funny how small the world becomes. But yeah, absolutely, the exposure. I think any family office would be prudent to have exposures to alternatives and hedge funds and other forms of investing.
I love it. All right. What else we have to talk about? Did we miss anything?
I cannot thank you enough. I've enjoyed this thoroughly. Been a lot of fun talking about things that I feel very passionate about. So thank you very much for giving me a platform to speak.
No worries. Thank you. And we heard it here. The trough is in. Freight's going to start climbing back up.
Any day now.
Did you know there was a group that was thinking about doing freight futures? I think it was like truckload futures, where companies could hedge against the freight prices rising or falling. I don't think it ever got off the ground, but that would be interesting, right?
That would be something. I'm probably not as adventurous I'm probably more towards the boring end of that logistics spectrum when I kind of continue to labor, but that would be something to see.
That would be interesting. All right, we'll leave it there, Chris. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me.
Yeah, we'll talk soon.
Thank you.
Okay, that's it for the pod. Thanks to Chris. Thanks to RCM for their support. Thanks to Jeff Berger for producing. We may be off next week. Have a little guest issue there, but we'll be back after that with a guest from trend follower Lauren Court. So go ahead and subscribe so you get it right when it drops. Peace.
You've been listening to The Derivative. Links from this episode will be in the episode description of this channel. Follow us on Twitter at RCMAlts and visit our website to read our blog or subscribe to our newsletter at RCMAlts.com. If you liked our show, introduce a friend and show them how to subscribe. And be sure to leave comments. We'd love to hear from you. This podcast is provided for informational purposes only and should not be relied upon as legal, business, investment, or tax advice. All opinions expressed by podcast participants are solely their own opinions and do not necessarily reflect the opinions of RCM Alternatives, their affiliates, or companies featured. Due to industry regulations, participants on this podcast are instructed not to make specific trade recommendations nor reference past or potential profits, and listeners are reminded that managed futures, commodity trading, and other alternative investments are complex and carry a risk of substantial losses. As such, they are not suitable for all investors.